Okay, so thank you so much for having me today. It's really excited to be at Perimeter, even if I'm not at Perimeter, but I'm still going to count it. And I'm very excited to tell you today about something that I've been working on for a while. And as I was sort of telling Neil a little bit earlier, we just got some preliminary results that I think are interesting, so those will be towards the end. So stay tuned. But yeah, I'm going to be telling you about ultralight dark matter dynamics in the language of eigenstates. And just as a quick overview, I think we're mostly cosmologists in here. But in any case, I will situate dark matter and specifically ultralight dark matter a little bit first and why we care about it, especially if you might not have heard about it. It's kind of growing, but still a little bit niche. Then I will talk about how I can calculate the eigenstates of the system and what fun things I can kind of learn with them. After that, we will move on to an example of what eigenstates can tell us for a realistic ULDM halo, so something that cosmologists might care a little bit more about than just the pure eigenstates. And note that I am somebody who does dark matter only simulations. So when I say realistic halo, that comes with a few asterisks and caveats and stuff like that. And finally, I will just recap what I told you and tell you where we're going with it. All right. So to start off, let's talk about ultralight dark matter or dark matter more generally. So as probably most people have heard, dark matter is this extremely mysterious thing that is about a quarter of our universe, and we have no idea what it is. One of my favorite quotes on that I heard at the Great Lakes Cosmology Workshop a few years ago, like a few months pre-COVID, where, and I can't remember who this was, but somebody got up and said, "Yeah, we're really getting a handle of this dark matter thing. We've narrowed it down to like 94 orders of magnitude." And that's very much how I feel. And so I think it's very exciting to think about because it's one big problem with so many different possible answers. But for today, looking at this wonderful, ultimate Venn diagram made by Tim Tate from UC Irvine, circa 2013, I believe there's a newer version circulating somewhere, but I haven't been able to find it. But in any case, on this diagram, we are going to be interested for the purposes of this talk in this corner where we talk about particles called axions. And so one of the motivations for thinking about axions is that everybody else is motivated to think about axions. For a long time, the dark matter was sort of like clearly a WIMP because that's the only thing that worked, but it's been a lot of years of not finding WIMPs. And so recently people have sort of started thinking about other things, including axions, which are sort of pretty simple extension to the standard model. You can make them in the early universe without, having to mess with a lot of stuff, and depending on the mass range, they might even solve the CP violation problem. And so axions have gotten more popular, as you can see on this kind of like just cutesy little graph. So here I'm just showing you the abstracts concerning WIMPs in blue at the American Physical Society April meeting as a function of time from like 2006, when dark matter was obviously a WIMP, to like 2020. And we can see that axions, both in the April meeting and in the March meeting, are really catching up, especially if you add them up. So just as a little tidbit to say that, hey, axions are interesting and other people are thinking about them. And in particular, the axion I think of is an axion-like scalar boson, which is to say that it has extremely low mass. Because of its ultralight mass, we call it ultralight dark matter. You might have also heard fuzzy dark matter, psi dark matter, Beck dark matter, BEC, Bose-Einstein condensate dark matter. It goes by many names. Some of these have subtle differences. Some of them are the same thing, but ultralight dark matter is the same as fuzzy dark matter. And so, like I mentioned, it's an ultralight scalar boson with incredibly low mass. So in those 94 orders of magnitude between the lowest dark matter mass and the highest dark matter mass, this is at the very low end. So it's 10 to the minus 22 EV. And just in case you aren't used to thinking of mass in EVs, or if this is just like a number that doesn't mean anything to you, comparing the mass of this particle to an electron is akin to comparing an electron to a tennis ball. So it's incredibly small. And because it's so small, we can sort of describe it with a classical limit of quantum language, and it forms these Bose-Einstein condensates that form cores at the very center of the halo. And so these cores are one of the original reasons that this candidate became interesting, because when you have core dark matter, you solve a whole lot of what's called small scale problems of cold dark matter. So for instance, you have the core cusp problem, which is illustrated here in this figure. So from all of the lovely N-body CDM simulations that have really like burst forth in, like the past 20, 30 years or so, when you try to characterize dark matter halos, what you get is this cuspy NFW profile that goes like this. So it goes as 1 over r, as r tends to 0, I believe, where r is just kind of like the radial distance, and this is density. However, some observations, specifically of dwarf galaxies, sort of seem to suggest that what we really should be expecting is a core, aka we expect the density to kind of like level out and go as a constant, which also just kind of like seems a little bit more physical because you don't expect the density to diverge at the center. And so there are many possible solutions for this problem. You can alleviate it with baryons, you can, do all this other stuff, but one possible solution is ultralight dark matter. And it just so happens that it also alleviates other small scale problems like the missing satellites problem and the too big to fail problem, which is overproducing large satellites and underproducing large small satellites in CDM simulations. But really, more than anything, the reason that I like it is that because the mass is so small and because it has this sort of quasi-quantum language, it has incredibly cool phenomenology that we can exploit and sort of like think about. And that's mostly what I'll be talking about today. And so, in order to show you that phenomenology, I have to acquaint you with the Schrödinger-Poisson system, which is the system of equations that governs ULDM. And so, depending on where you are in your physics education, these might be equations that you've probably seen before. So, if you've ever taken quantum, the top equation should be kind of familiar. This is the Schrödinger equation, where the evolution of the wave function of the dark matter psi, right, psi dot, is a function of the Laplacian of the wave function. Here, m is the mass of the particle, and this is modulated by phi, where phi is the gravitational potential of the dark matter. So this the shape of the dark matter is described by a wave function. That wave function is told to evolve by gravity, aka by the gravitational potential. On the other hand, the gravitational potential evolves with the wave function because the way that the mass is arranged tells tells the halo what its gravitational potential is, which is shown here in the Poisson equation. So again, we have phi, which is the gravitational potential of 4 pi g. M is the mass of the axion or axion-like particle, and here we have absolute value of psi squared. And the way to think of this is that absolute value of psi squared times the mass of the particle just describes the density. So the density of the halo follows the wave function squared, which you might be used to thinking of as probability in quantum systems. So this is these are the nice equations that we solve in order to simulate ultralight dark matter, and these are the equations that we can exploit to get at the at ULDM's eigensystems. And so, in order to talk about how we get to its eigensystem and its eigenstates, I'm going to bring you right back here to the same system of equations with one small caveat, which is that this potential here I've put in brackets. And so, this seems like a very small notational difference, but actually, these brackets are doing a lot of work. What they are saying is, let me imagine a system of ULDM, such as, say, an isolated halo, right? Where the potential isn't evolving that much in time. Like it has some oscillations, but it mostly oscillates around some average, number, which describes this potential very well. In that case, I can make a substitution and say, hey, how about I just put this in this non-time evolving potential in here? And that's a pretty good description of my system. That's a pretty small error to make. And this is pretty cool, or this is pretty powerful, because that means that I no longer care about the Poisson equation, and psi squared doesn't, appear anywhere here. So I'm not really solving the rho equation either, even though it's trivial. And so what I am left with is the Schrödinger equation with a constant potential. And that is something that I know how to work with. That is something that is a thing whose eigensystem I can solve, mostly by putting it into Mathematica and asking it very nicely to solve it for me. And so this system is described by this choice of potential with which I can make. And for, a reasonable choice of potential that looks like a ULDM halo with the little core in the center, I get eigenstates that look a little something like this. So like with most quantum systems, there are three quantum numbers that you can use to sort of index this system. So there's N, L, and M quantum numbers. I'm going to try to be very deliberate with my pronunciations because I recognize that they can get a little bit gurgled. For the duration of this talk, I'm going to set the M number to zero, which is equivalent to considering axisymmetric systems. There's nothing particularly special or sacred about this choice. I'm just doing it to simplify how many quantum numbers we're looking at once. And so with that, I can look at these radial profiles of the different eigenstates for different N and L numbers, right? So the N number is like the radial number, basically, in the sense that it controls how many nodes I see in the radial wave function. So here, N equals zero, I have zero nodes in each of these. For N equals one, I have one node. For N equals two, I have two nodes, etc. On the other hand, the L number is the number that controls how the profile behaves as R goes to zero. So here it goes to R to the L. L is zero here, so it goes to a constant. So this is this nice core that I like seeing. Here it goes as R to the one, so it falls off as R to the one. Here it falls off as R to the two, etc. And so of all of these eigenstates, which you can calculate as many of as you like, basically, the one that we really care about is this, the N equals zero, L equals zero, M equals zero ground state, which is also just called a soliton. So this is the state that corresponds to that core from the Bose-Einstein condensation at the center of our halo. And so this is the state that we're really interested in. And so these are just sort of like radial profiles of what the states look like. But the question is, what do they do? How do they impact the evolution of my system? And so for that, I have a little GIF illustration. So each of these here is a soliton, so a ground state that I have superimposed with one excited state to see kind of what the qualitative behavior of the system is when that happens. So for instance, here, excuse me, I superimpose the soliton within N equals one, L equals zero state. That means that's a spherically symmetric state with one node. And what I see is something called the breathing mode. I see the soliton going in and out and oscillating, kind of becoming denser and then puffier. And this is really interesting because this is something that's seen very often in ULDM simulations. And so we were able to match it to exactly the type of mode that is responsible for this behavior. So, for instance, if you're looking at a halo in a simulation of ultralight dark matter and you see it doing this, you know that you have some like N equals one or N equals two, higher N, L equals zero modes, which is pretty cool. In the center here, we have the soliton that is excited by an L equals one mode, which is to say non-spherically symmetric. And so what is happening here is you can see that the red dot at the very center is moving left and right. So L equals one modes will cause the center of mass to oscillate in the system, which is also something that has been seen in simulations. One of the reasons why these things are kind of hard to quantify is because the profile keeps oscillating, and then also the center of mass of it can move around the center. And again, we've been able to identify which mode does that exactly. And then here we just have an L equals two mode. And what you see is this nice quadrupole moment. If you do anything with gravitational waves, you might be familiar with quadrupoles that are, the thing that causes gravitational waves in general. We didn't test this for gravitational wave backgrounds. It would probably be extremely low, but just as an example. I think I
Yeah, I have a
heard a
question.
mic
May I
unmute.
ask?
Yes.
This L equal one mode. Yeah, I'm interested about this. Yeah, I would guess it should be actually zero mode. Yeah, because I have translation invariance in the system, right? So if I just take the soliton and shift it, that should not cost me any energy. So yeah, basically, where is this mode corresponding to kind of uniform motion of the soliton in your picture?
Sorry, I'm not 100% sure I understood your question. Why is this happening? Is that
Yeah, so they
or
are considering j just yeah, they're considering just the soliton, right? Well, in the sense they are considering gravity and they are considering the scalar field and gravity produced by it, right? So then the
yes.
ground state is the soliton, that's right. But then I also have another state, which is the uniform motion of the soliton, and that should correspond to some kind of zero mode excitation. Zero mode means that its frequency is zero, essentially, yeah, because it's uniform motion.
Right, so the ground state is excited here by the L equals one mode, and so it's the difference in their phases, which are set by their eigenenergies, which is causing them to move around.
Yeah, because that's about this oscillation. So actually, to have oscillations, I must have some external confining potential. But where does it come from? Yeah, that's what I'm
Well, so, I mean, if you like, these are all simulations that are done in a box. So, you know, there is a sort of unintended potential that comes from the fact that you have a box. And so it does, you know, we force our potential to go to zero somewhere at the edge of our box. And so we try to set it far enough that it doesn't affect the lowest excited states as much, but you know, you are always dealing with that that sort of caveat, if that's what you're asking.
So you're not using periodic boundary conditions.
Not in this particular one, no.
I see. Okay.
Just to clarify, sorry for me, Luna. So in your calculations, there is a potential, namely the time averaged, you know, potential coming from all of these. You know, eigenmodes added up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Right. So for Sergei's question, you know, that translation mode wouldn't have zero frequency just because, you know, the overall potential would then cause, you know, the soliton, if it's sloshed, to slosh back towards the bottom of the potential, wouldn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
But what are these additional modes? Then I'm confused about it, because here you don't have a halo. Yeah, I understand when I consider soliton in the halo. Yeah, then there is the gradation potential of the whole halo. But here I thought that you are just considering an isolated soliton.
No. So what I do, okay, I think I understand. Sorry, I think I misunderstood your question. So what I have in that particular one is I take the soliton, which is the ground state, and then I take this N0 L equals one state. And so as I'm evolving them, I consider the potential. So as I evolve them, I solve for the potential fully. I don't make assumptions that the potential is constant, right? But in order to get to these eigenstates strictly only correspond to the potential that I have chosen, right? Because there's not a universal set of eigenstates for any ULDN system. I'm making the assumption that a system that I'm interested in has an approximately constant potential. And so whether I calculate eigenstates from like the maximum oscillation of the potential or the minimum oscillation of the potential, it doesn't make much of a difference. It's a small approximation. So the potential is constant.
Yes, let me rephrase. So what potential do you choose? Yeah, maybe that will answer my question. I can see. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll get into this a little bit more when I get to the halo portion of my talk as well. So for this particular case, I chose the potential corresponding to the soliton. So that's kind of a good check that you reproduce the same soliton with the potential. But also we have done quite a lot of these. And so long as it's extremely equivalent to choosing a halo that has a soliton of the same mass. So long as you choose something that looks kind of like ultralight dark matter in that it has a soliton towards the center, you will get the same set of eigenstates just modulated by the mass that is in them.
Okay, thank you.
Does that now answer your question? Sorry about that.
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, great. Okay.
Can I actually also add something here?
Yes.
So in these examples that you're showing, you know, like the higher NLM eigenstates that you're adding to the ground state, their amplitudes, I guess, are similar to the ground state amplitude. Is that right?
Okay, so in this case, I perturb them by about 30%, just to have like the ground state dominate, and then this be a sort of like smallish perturbation on the ground state, but large enough that it's kind of like caricatured in these just GIFs, so you can see them mostly for like the visual reasons. My next step is that I will compare this to perturbation theory, where I will kind of have very small perturbations so that I can verify my results more quantitatively. Does that kind of get at what you were getting at? Or?
Yeah, kind of. Okay, but just to follow up more. So for cases where you have like super small halos that have like enormous solitons, where the ground state amplitude is like much, much higher than the amplitudes of the other modes. In those cases, then, should I not expect to see the sort of sloshing motion?
No, you should still expect to see the sloshing motion, because even if you do a fairly small perturbation, it's there. The question of how big of the like amplitude to either the sloshing or the breathing mode, that will depend on the amplitude. And I have some tests about that as well. But basically, no, you would be hard pressed, I think, to find a halo that is so little perturbed that the soliton basically doesn't oscillate. That might be interesting for other systems that use the Schrodinger-Poisson equations, though. But I think for sort of like, especially Milky Way size or even dwarf galaxy size like ULDM halos, you would see quite a bit of perturbation onto the soliton in order to sort of like fit those nice outskirts the way that CDM does.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, okay, great. And so Chris also has his hand raised. Yeah, so go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, please.
Sorry for the continued interruption. I was just wondering.
No, please.
Isn't the L equals one mode sort of special because it does involve an oscillation of the center of mass? So that sounds as though if you solve the full system, it would have to have zero amplitude because there's nothing, you know, conservation of momentum would imply that the center of mass has to move in a uniform motion.
So the L equals mode does, L equals one mode does appear to be kind of special. And in fact, it caused me many headaches this past summer looking for bugs that turned out not to exist. Depending on the system that you are solving, you expect that that the center of mass will be conserved because you want to have translational symmetry and all of that good stuff. That turns out not to be true in the perturbation theory, the way that we set it up. And so there will be a bit of a divergence there. And I'll show that in just a few slides. Would it be okay?
Sorry. So that's finish. Just the consequence of having fixed the potential, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, sorry. Anybody else? Okay, cool. So in any case, I've revealed my hand a little bit in sort of what we'll get into, but in any case, this is sort of a qualitative idea of how these systems evolve, which is nice because the left and the center here show us effects that we do indeed see in ULDM simulations that are sometimes kind of a pain to deal with. And then the next question is, can I get a little bit more quantitative than that and make sure that this evolution is what I expect? And so for the start, let's focus on this left case where we have the breathing mode because we've perturbed with a spherically symmetric mode, and let's watch the modes evolve. And so that figure looks a little bit something like this. So I'm going to ask you to first pay attention to the inset where I have shown the evolution of the soliton in blue here. The soliton has been perturbed by 5% in the wave function. 5% squared in the mass of the N equals one mode, which is shown in yellow, which oscillates here around 0.05, which is shown in the gray in the back. And then the second excited mode in green and the third excited mode in orange, I guess, here are excited just through the contribution of the first excited mode. Neil, to kind of get back to your question a little bit, because this perturbation is so small, you can basically see that the soliton stays fairly constant for this. So if it's a, 2.5 perturbation in the mass of stuff that isn't in the soliton stays constant to better than 0.1%, I believe. But if you get a little bit higher than that, and in most systems you would, you start to see the soliton kind of have more visible oscillations. But in any case, we can zoom into just this because this is sort of the qualitative where the stuff is happening. And that's the big picture. So you can see still the N equals one mode oscillating, the N equals two and N equals three kind of get excited, but to amplitudes that are smaller than the N equals one mode, which I just set. And then in the gray are all of the higher N equals four plus modes shown that aren't differentiated, just to basically say that, these are excited to smaller and smaller amplitudes. So this system is sort of well described by the lowest few states that are excited. Right. So as promised, I can do a little bit better than this quantitatively. So because this perturbation is so small and because the soliton stays so close to constant, I can compare this with perturbation theory to make sure that I'm happy with my results. And indeed, I am. So here, instead of plotting all of the modes on one y-axis, I've separated them. So this is the darker colors are the case that we just looked at. So this is the N equals one mode that we just saw oscillating around 0.05, which is where I set it. And in the black dashed, you can see the perturbation theory calculation, which is pretty correct, though it gets, kind of like farther from farther from the simulation as time goes on. And you can also see the n equals 2 mode, which gets excited from 0, also matching very nicely to perturbation theory, and the n equals 3 mode here. So we verified those pretty well. And just to make sure that we didn't choose a special case for some reason, we can look at the case where we perturb by the n equals 2 mode instead. So here's the n equals 2, or sorry, here's the n equals 2 mode in the lighter colors and sort of buttressed by perturbation theory here, which causes the n equals 1 mode to excite to a smaller amplitude and the n equals 3 mode to excite to an even smaller amplitude. So far so good. Perturbation theory says that we are doing pretty well. Now, this was the spherically symmetric case, so in some sense this is simpler. What we can also do is look at the non-spherically symmetric case, so look at some L's of 1 and higher as our perturbers. And so that will look a little bit something like this. So this is a slightly different figure than what I just showed you. So here I am showing you CL, which I'm defining as the sum of all CNLs squared over n and then square rooted, which is to say how much of the contribution is in each of the L's instead of each of the n's, because if I, you know, look at each of the L's and n's individually, I'll have so many figures to show you. And so let's focus on the top figure here for now. So in the blue, again, we see the L equals 0 modes, including the soliton that stay pretty constant around 1. In the yellow, we see the L equals 1 modes, which are here used as a perturber. L equals 1, N equals 0 is used as a perturber, which stay fairly constant at the level to which they are excited, so like 0.05. Then we see the L equals 2 modes, which are excited and oscillate a bit. Don't be fooled by the largesse of these oscillations. These are very small numbers, so the log-log scale kind of blows them up. We can see L equals 4, and then L equals 5 that's sort of like at the, is basically not excited because it's sort of below the noise floor. So this is all nonsense. The other thing that we can do is we can try the same perturbations, but with a higher amplitude. So an amplitude of 0.25, five times higher. And so what you see is that that's shown in the dashed and lighter here. And so each of these modes just moves up, and you can see that now the purple is actually excited and showing what we expect to see. So it's exciting enough that we see results. And again, just to make sure, as noted, the L equals 1 mode is kind of special, and so just to make sure that we aren't looking at a very particular case here, we can do the same thing where we excite by L equals 2. And so again, we have the soliton, which basically doesn't care. We have the L equals 2 mode at 0.05, which is where we started it off. We have this L equals 4 mode that is being excited, though it starts kind of weird, so I would be wary that this is also more more noise than mode. And basically, you don't see all of the odd modes are even below that and basically below the noise floor, because odd, odd modes will excite even modes, but even modes will excite other even modes. And so the same thing we can do, we can check the version where we have a much larger oscillation. And so what happens is that both of these jump up, right? So they're just doing the same thing, just at a slightly higher amplitude. The soliton is still pretty chilling. It's plotted, it's just below this line. It doesn't vary enough for you to see it. And these modes also kind of perk up a little bit, though not so much that they're showing us the oscillations. So because it seems that all of these L modes are sort of, you know, they're more or less straight lines with small oscillations, not a lot of, you know, mass is being traded between the L modes, what we want to look at is a single L mode and look at its individual N components, and also compare those to perturbation theory. And so we can do that with something like this. So this is similar to the figure that I showed you two slides ago. And so this is the version where we, so again, let's start with the darker, and here we perturbed the soliton by the L equals 1, N equals 1 mode, so this yellow mode here. And we can see that that's very nicely matched with perturbation theory. We can see that the L equals 1, N equals 0 mode starts from 0, but then gets excited to a pretty small amplitude. And the same thing with the L equals 2, or L equals 1, N equals 2 mode, and the L equals 1, N equals 3 mode, right? Which, you know, this is the smallest one, so it diverges the most from perturbation theory, though it's still pretty good. And again, we can do the same thing with a slightly different mode. So we can instead excite the n equals 1, l equals 2 mode, which is shown in the lighter here, and the corresponding modes in the other l's are shown in the lighter. And so basically they get excited, but not too much, and they match perturbation theory really well. So that is the story of our perturbed solitons. We qualitatively have interesting ideas about what they do to the evolution of the system. We can track quantitatively what's happening to each individual mode in the system, and we can compare those to perturbation theory for the cases where there's small excitations. And so that's all really promising. And with that, we can move on to an example of, you know, a more realistic halo and see this a little bit more in cosmological action. So I'm just going to pause for a minute here to see if there are any remaining lingering questions about that bit. And take a sip of coffee. All right. If no, great. Let's carry on. So thus far, they've been all perturbed solitons. Now let's look at what a ULDM halo might look like in action. So this is a real simulation that I ran. This is a halo that I created by initializing 8 randomly placed equal mass solitons in a box and letting them collide at the center to form a halo, which is one of the tried and true methods of making ULDM halos in sort of in idealized cosmological simulations when you don't have an evolving background and, you know, spherical collapse and all of that good stuff. And so in the grayscale here, I show snapshots of the potential pretty evenly spaced of the density of the halo pretty evenly spaced after it's created. And in the blue, I show their average. So you can see that sort of the actual potential or the actual density, pardon, doesn't actually change all that much. You know, all of these are kind of pretty good approximations to the blue. And so I can say, great, this, I can take this blue potential, I can calculate my eigenstates, I can decompose my simulation into the eigenstates, and because this is such a nice and staticky system, I should see, you know, like really beautiful eigenstate evolution that tells me a whole lot about the system. Should is a good word in physics. That turned out not to be quite true. So what we see here is that the eigenstates vary a lot, and again, we're looking at the CL squared in this case, I guess, and we're looking at the contribution to each of the L's. So it's hard to glean a very clean picture from this, though we did get some very, very good and interesting feedback from our referee, so there might still be ways to clean up this picture. Stay tuned for that. But for now, I'll just say that, you know, a few of the sort of, if you wanted to draw conclusions from this picture, the conclusions that you would draw is that the L equals one modes, which are shown in blue, do tend to dominate, though not always. They seem to be overtaken by the L equals one mode here. And the soliton, so just the L equals zero, N equals zero mode, is shown in the gray in the background, also tends to dominate, but it's not exactly a straight line or anything. And it's, you know, only, what, 20-30% of the system as it peaks. And so you can't exactly, you can't model this as a perturbed soliton, right? It really is a sort of turbulent system, and higher excited modes seem to be excited all the time. You might be tempted to see the all of these colors kind of like going up right here and think, hey, these are, you know, these are doing something interesting. There's some final state that we're tending to. Nope, I evolved it for just as long after this, and they just go right back down. So there doesn't seem to be a clean picture of a final state, though, like I said, we got some interesting comments on it, so maybe we can do a little bit better in the future. In the meantime, one way to sort of beat down the turbulence here and try to draw some conclusions is, instead of initializing a halo by colliding very randomly placed solitons, what I can do is sort of game the system a little bit and initialize a halo by placing very symmetric solitons. And so here I am showing, I'm tracking just the evolution of the soliton mode squared. So basically what this tells you is what percentage of the halo mass is in the soliton as a function of time, which is in code units here. And what I have here is different numbers of solitons that I'm colliding. So the N equals 2 is just a binary collision of solitons that forms a halo. And this is very nice because we see here that there's 0, 0, 0 soliton, and then we say a pretty sudden increase, and then a, you know, oscillation around about 0.6, which is to say that the central soliton of the halo, the core, is formed sort of like quickly and evidently, and then it oscillates around the same, approximately the same number. So it stays pretty constant. And this is something that remains mostly true. Obviously, there are nicer ones and uglier ones as you go to higher numbers of solitons. I will say that figuring out how to collide, 12 solitons so simultaneously was a very interesting exercise in Pythagorean, or not Pythagorean, well, in the solids, whatever, sorry, in Platonic solids, that's the one. So that was a very interesting exercise in Platonic solids, but it worked out. And so what we can see is that the higher number of solitons that we collide, corresponding to a higher mass of the halo, the lower and lower the percentage of mass of the halo ends up in the soliton, which is, an interesting result.
Just to clarify for me, so in your initial conditions, like what you're doing is that you're putting in like 12 or 14, are you starting from identical blobs at rest in some symmetric configuration?
Absolutely. That's okay. Absolutely what's happening. So, there's a use for icosahedra you never considered before. So this is a very specific way of initializing a halo. I'm not claiming that the universe owes us an icosahedron of solitons to form like the Milky Way or anything, but this is sort of like building up intuition from a more symmetric place so that we can, analyze our data as well as possible. So these are all arranged extremely symmetrically around the center of mass, and they all collide at the center simultaneously and all have the same mass. So as symmetric as you can possibly make it.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Yeah, for sure.
In the early works, there was a claim that there is some correlation between the mass of the halo that forms in cosmological simulations and the mass of the soliton.
Could I ask you to hold your question for like three more slides?
Okay.
Because I do get into that a little bit more. And then if I don't answer your question, please ask again. Is that okay?
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Great. Love that we're on the same page as to where we're going. So in any case, as we form these very symmetric halos, we see this kind of like pretty constant percentage of the halo going into the mass of the final core. Great. However, what happens when we don't do that as symmetrically, or rather when we change up the merger history? So for instance, here I'm showing you the N equals 4 case, where I have 4 solitons merging simultaneously and then jump up to this, fairly constant, not as pretty as the binary, but still fairly constant number of like 0.4, 0.42 or something, versus giving 2 of the solitons initial velocity such that they merge in the center first and then the other 2 merge second. Which is shown as the sequential merger here in yellow. And so not only is the evolution of the percentage of the soliton with respect to the whole halo different, the final percentage is different, right? These don't end up at the same number. And so that's pretty curious. And that kind of tells us that it's not just how many solitons of how many masses and what mass ratios you collide, it's very much the order that you collide them in. And so the reason that this is interesting, and Sergey, I think this is what you might have been aiming at, is that there is a very fundamental prediction of ultralight dark matter in the literature called the core halo mass relation, right? If the reason that I like this this dark matter model is that it has a core at the center, which corresponds to its eigenstate, it's pretty important to me how big of a core I expect in like the Milky Way versus a dwarf galaxy versus like Andromeda versus whatever, right? And so there's been a fair bit of work about this in the literature, including from 3 groups, which I'm showing here, which is not a full lit review, but just 3 examples. So the Shui et al. Taiwanese group that did that kind of started off this whole fad and did some excellent work. So they find that the mass of the halo correlates with a slope of this parameter, which is the absolute value of the total energy over mass cubed, which we will call Xi, as a slope to the 1/2 power. Schwabe et al. In 2016, using just binary soliton collisions, found that this can kind of vary. They might have a quarter, they might have a sixth, they don't really have a half. And then Mox et al. In 2017 initialized these halos by colliding a whole lot of solitons and different initial masses and everything, and found a 1/3 scaling. So this is a very important prediction that we have, and there are almost as many predictions as there are papers on it. So, just in these 3, there's a 1/2, 1/3, and 1/4 to 1/6 option. Question?
Yeah, so in the left one, that was started from cosmological initial conditions, is that right? Yes. And then the other one is from this. So
absolutely. So this one is a little bit different. So there's not an a priori reason, or I wouldn't be surprised to find that my way of colliding solitons is different than a cosmological initial condition and like a simulation that actually evolves. I would be surprised that it's different than these two, which do collide solitons, and also that that these are different from each other. So for the purposes of this, I am comparing myself with the right two here, not necessarily with the left. So that is an important caveat. So there's not necessarily a consensus in the literature. And since we already have this nice system of eigenstates where we are able to extract the percentage of the core mass very easily, so we can do the same thing for our data. And it looks a little bit something like this. So here I have three different runs where I collide different numbers of solitons. And then, you know, in the blue, all of the solitons have a mass of 40 in code units, 50 in code units, or 60 in code units. It doesn't really matter. The point is that they're all sort of equal mass, and I'm using them to fill out the space in some sense. And so we get this fairly nice scaling, though it does get much more scattered towards small size, which corresponds to large masses of 0.215, which is sort of closest to the Mach scaling of 1/4. It's certainly much closer than either a third or a half. The Schwabe scaling. And so that is an interesting direction to go in, right, as a beginning. But as I said, it turns out that how you collide these things seems to matter. So I don't necessarily expect the same thing for simultaneous mergers and what I'm calling sequential mergers. And in fact, I can compare those two. So here in the blue is the exact same data you saw just now. I'm just eliding what the individual masses, initial soliton masses of the runs are, because in some sense it shouldn't matter. And then in the yellow here, we have sequential mergers. What I mean by sequential mergers is that it's still a very symmetric system, but I set it up such that two mergers happen simultaneously first, and then the products of those mergers collide in a binary merger. So that is to say, if I have my splatter of 8 solitons together, 4 and 4 collide first, and then the products of those collide at the center, and those are the halo that I get. And so when I use all of my data to fit them, I get kind of similar results, which are, you know, approximately 1/4-ish or a 1/5-ish or something like that. You know, these lines are almost parallel, basically. And just for reference, the gray is the 1/4 scaling, just so you can see sort of how it diverges. Though, of course, you would see that this, you know, I would be hard pressed to be convinced of the goodness of this fit based on sort of this data here that is pretty scattered. And the reason that I am worried about that, or I would be worried about that sort of data, is that solitons have this nasty habit that when they get more massive, they get smaller. So the size of the soliton scales inversely with its mass. So the more massive your halo is, the more massive your core is, the smaller it is, and the more you're susceptible to numerical effects. So that's one reason why I'm sort of, you know, squinting at this part of the fit. The other reason is that, you know, as I indicated before, these are sort of very symmetrically arranged, like very specific initial conditions that the universe doesn't owe us. And if I were to compare with, say, Mox's run, which had, again, a bunch of solitons in a box of different masses, kind of like merging, you know, as they see fit, really, you would mostly see binary mergers, maybe 3 merging at once, maybe. But, you know, you would be hard pressed to find 15 solitons merging at once, or 7 and 7 and then in the center. And so just for curiosity, and again, this is preliminary data, but I think it is interesting. If we decide to cut off at a maximum of 10 solitons in the box, so not these sort of like hypersymmetric mergers, that changes the fit a whole lot. So for the simultaneous fit, it still stays pretty close to 1/4, or I mean, it's closer to 1/5, but it's certainly closer to 1/4 than a third. Whereas the sequential mergers do show sort of a nicer third scaling. And moreover, these two scalings intersected these three, which are my binary mergers, which there's no way to sequentially merge a binary Right. And so again, I have to underline that this is an asterisk. This is preliminary data that I'm just getting. But it does seem to point to the fact that at least in the cases where you're emerging solitons rather than starting from cosmological initial conditions, you can sort of get a whole lot of different scalings of the core halo mass relation, depending on how you decide to extract your solitons and, you know, what mass range you consider and things like that. So this is an evolving story of, you know, kind of like reconciling the different scalings in the core halo mass relation. And it's fun to, you know, hopefully soon be able to say that maybe everybody was right. And so with that, I will move on to my conclusions and just a quick reminder of what we went to. So I started you off by telling you all about these perturbed solitons, which we can model with perturbation theory really, really well. We also looked at ULDM halos with random initial conditions, which aren't as simple to model with perturbation theory, unfortunately, but we can still decompose the full simulation and see what the individual modes are doing. So we do see a persistent soliton, even if it's not very well behaved. We don't see a clear emerging late time state, and we see that higher order modes are continuously excited. So we do have, again, I'm going to repeat, we do have some sort of like interesting directions to go to try and make this a little bit more better behaved. And so hopefully that'll be in our paper if we are successful. Finally, we looked at ULDM halo with extremely symmetric initial conditions from which a cleaner picture in the eigenstates emerges. And we see a really quick and evident formation of the soliton core, which is pretty cool. And reveals that sort of hierarchical core formation does matter in terms of the core halo mass relation and might point to why there are different scalings in the literature. And so in some of our future work and current work that's going on, we are rounding off our picture of the core halo mass relation with unequal mass soliton mergers. So that is our next step. And that will be even more Moxian in its initial condition. So hopefully we should converge towards the 1/3 scaling, though I guess we never know. And we're also considering sort of baryonic effects in ULDM halos, which you can model with external potentials. So for instance, we're using a time-varying Hernquist potentials to model supernova feedback inside ULDM halos and compare how good they are at stripping mask as compared to like CDM predictions. And you can also model, say, baryonic disks as an external potential as the Miyamoto Nagai potential. And that should give us a little bit more of an idea of how the dark matter corresponds to baryons, even if not how baryons correspond to dark matter. And so finally, I just wanted to say another thanks for having me. I was at the Perimeter Institute for the TRICEP summer school in 2018, and I had a really great time. So it's great to be back, even if virtually, and just, you know, like three cheers to a fallen institution, which is Chainsawed, which I believe is not open anymore, unfortunately. But with that, thanks again. And are there any more questions?
Okay, great. Thanks, Mubluna. So let's all unmute to give her a round of applause for her great talk. Okay, great. So we have time for more questions. So please, anyone who has a question, go. Yeah, okay, yeah, Sergey, see your hand raised.
Yeah, I think I have many questions. Thank you very nice. Thank you very much for the nice talk. So my questions. So one thing is, okay, you made the simulations when you form like halo and the soliton. Like, have you looked at what happens with the soliton afterwards? I mean, does it change? Does it mass change? Or
anyway. Yeah. So let me.
Well, apart from oscillations, yeah, I saw you have some oscillations, but yeah, did you try to look further? You know, for longer times.
So for these individual ones, we didn't look that much further because, you know, particularly for some of these higher mass ones, they merge much quicker, right? Because you just have more mass, so they get to the center quicker. And so these stay pretty constant towards the end, you know. So here you're talking about, you know, more than like 70% of the simulation or something is the halo is already formed and the soliton seems very consistent. We can absolutely run longer simulations, but I guess this seemed like pretty telling to me that it sort of stays. The other thing to note is that here I am running, I'm learning non-ideal or idealized boxes, right, with isolated boundary conditions. And so in some sense, this is kind of telling to me that the soliton itself doesn't change that much because of the effect of the halo in the situation where I formed it with very symmetric initial conditions. But there's nothing else in my box to perturb it afterwards. So that is just one caveat to note that, you know, like the universe doesn't owe you a pristine box for your soliton to remain unperturbed for like many.
Right.
Many
but there were simulations where that showed that actually, like the at longer time scales, there's certain like relaxation time scale where which is characteristic for this halo to relax, and for and that could also affect the soliton in principle on the same time scales.
Yeah, so thus far I have never seen that in any of my simulations. I've heard of that. I've seen some simulations where it seems like sort of like the soliton is either increasing or decreasing in mass. I think most of them have been increasing, and so it seems like, you know, at some sort of like very long time scale all of the mass might be sucked back into the ground state, which, you know, you could understand why that would be reasonable, because it is it like a self-gravitating attractive solution, mm-hmm, etc. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that in my simulations.
I see.
So I wouldn't be surprised to see it, but I personally can't speak to it.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
One last question. So in the cosmological, so what is special about cosmological simulation? Do you have any idea why that could give this power 1/2?
I guess I don't know what would be special initially. So what I said at the beginning is that kind of like this might be, before I started my talk, is that this might be leading to, you know, a thing that I've been like really excited to show ideally for like 2 years, which is that basically the core halo mass relation isn't necessarily universal. And so I don't have an immediate reason why necessarily the cosmological simulation would be different, but I would understand that I'm making very different assumptions. I have different, I have different boundary conditions than a cosmological simulation. And also I'm forming halos through collisions of solitons, which is one way to form halos. I'm not forming them from spherical collapse. One thing that I've been toying with doing is we have a very simple version of a 1D simulation that we use just for like the spherically symmetric cases if we want to like gain quick intuition. And so I have been toying with just like running a set of simulations with, you know, like top hat over densities and just seeing, do they collapse, how they collapse, how quickly they collapse. I admit that I haven't got to it quite yet, but I would be very curious, and that is definitely something that's on my horizon, to see like how the formation mechanism is different. But, you know, just even putting that aside, I guess, you know, I would not be necessarily surprised to not see a 1/2, because I am making a lot of different assumptions. I was surprised to neither get a quarter nor a third. And I spent a lot of time maybe, two and a half years ago when I was in New Zealand, actually, or whenever COVID started, thinking about this very closely. And so like, finally I understood that the reason that I couldn't match the core halo mass relation wasn't a bug in my code, but it was just that my simulations didn't produce the core halo mass relation. And in fact, other simulations hadn't been able to produce it either, including from sister codes like Pi Ultralight at University of Auckland, which is extremely similar to the code that we use. And so I do think that all of this points to something being extremely model dependent in this core halo mass relation, which is important because that is the thing that many of the like observational sort of like mass constraints are based on assuming that you know how big the like core of the Milky Way would be or something like that. And the answer is we just might not.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
Yeah. Further questions for Luna? I can ask something like, so I was curious to hear more about your plans, you know, to account for the galaxy and its time variation, for example. So your system right now, it sounds like you are treating like a time average potential as being spherically symmetric, which makes things, yeah, like so much easier. But once you put in this, you know, non-spherically symmetric galaxy, then solving for the eigenfunctions sounds like a much more challenging problem.
It is.
Yeah. So you mentioned something about that. So I was just curious to hear more.
Yeah. No. Great question. So the truth here, to be just like very very blatant, is that we started with the Miyamoto Nagai baryonic disks, which caused these sort of like interesting oscillations in the wave function. And then we thought, oh hey, we should analyze this with eigenstates. But if I'm to analyze this with eigenstates, I need to think of ways to solve the axisymmetric Schrodinger equation, and that turned out to be more of a pain. I do think it's doable because what we use basically for solving these equations is we use sparse matrices. So, you know, you need a matrix that tells you how the Laplacian works in your chosen coordinates, and you need one that tells you how the potential works. And so I haven't quite gotten to the point of having my eigenstates for the baryonic disks, mostly because we realized that, like, hey, we can use a very similar thing to do supernova feedback, except that is spherically symmetric, and so we can, you know, make faster inroads on it. So currently our focus is on the supernova feedback problem because solving a 2D or axisymmetric Schrodinger equation is kind of a pain. We do have a path forward. I just sort of haven't pursued it because I kind of looked at it and went, ooh, that's a little thorny. Let me wrap up some things first and then get enmeshed in it.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Okay, any further questions for our speaker? Going once, going twice. Okay. So let's stop here, Varsha. So thanks again to our speaker for her wonderful talk. And thank you all for coming again. And then we'll see you, I guess, next week. All right, so bye, everyone.
Thanks, all.